Modern monetary theory, or MMT for short, was all the rage in 2020, proclaiming that we should not worry about the deficit itself, but rather about whether or not government spending is causing inflation. This theory became so influential that it even inspired Joe Biden's gigantic COVID stimulus package, after which inflation shot up rapidly in the United States and elsewhere. So that raises the question, in these inflationary times, is modern monetary theory still relevant? Well, luckily at the Warwick Economics Summit 2024, I had the opportunity to talk to Professor Stephanie Kelton, the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy, about precisely this question. Specifically, we discussed how her book is holding up today, what drove the inflation spike, the role of central bank monetary policy versus government fiscal policy, the role of supply in causing inflation, and whether or not modern monetary theory still applies to countries outside of the United States, such as the United Kingdom, which faced the so-called gilt crisis in 2022 after a big tax cut proposal by then Prime Minister Liz Truss. So, without further ado, here's my in-depth conversation with Professor Stephanie Kelton. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me here at Money and Macro Talks. We're going to talk about, is modern monetary theory still relevant? And then mostly in relation to this book that you wrote in 2020. And I figured let's just start it lightly by posing a gotcha question. That is, you wrote in this book, which is the paperback edition, on page 13, you wrote something, and I think that didn't come true. So there's a prediction that didn't come true. But I think you like that it didn't come true. Because you wrote, if history, you know, this is about COVID, and the first COVID stimulus had already happened, if history is any lesson, anxiety over rising budget deficits will lead to pressure to reduce fiscal support in order to wrestle deficits lower. That didn't happen. After that, Biden passed another stimulus round. I wanted to ask this in relation. Could it be that modern monetary policy, or at least the deficit myth, is no longer relevant in the sense that, you know, they didn't think, oh, it's just a deficit. They thought about the real deficit, and that was the problems that COVID brought.
Okay, so I'm not exactly sure which package had passed, because this paperback edition came out, well, in March.
Yeah, before Biden was elected. So this was the Trump package.
Okay,
yeah,
So the package that was first passed when Biden was elected and came out is actually the package that I helped work on. I was on the advisory committee for the incoming Biden administration. And that's where that $1.9 trillion package was initially envisioned. So I knew in the summer of 2020, before the election, that if the Democrats were successful and the opportunity presented itself, that the president was going to push for a $1.9 trillion package. And he ended up doing that. No one could have imagined that Democrats would win those two seats in Georgia that gave them the Senate that allowed this. So, you know, I'm thinking politically also, like the likelihood of something like that happening, as well as just the psychology of being willing to push for another round of very large fiscal support on the heels of what had already been done. So you're right to say that I was pleasantly surprised, not just that they could pass that piece of legislation, but that they went on to do so much more after that.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that, because I think it's pretty well known that you have worked with Bernie Sanders. But maybe it's my ignorance, but I think it's less well known, at least, that you also work with the first Biden administration.
Yeah, so in the summer of 2020, Senator Sanders and Joe Biden put together, they worked collaboratively, and they said, we want to try to bring together some people who have ideas that represent the Sanders sort of, if you like, wing of the Democratic Party, together with people who would be part of an incoming administration if Joe Biden were to win. So they established, I think, six working groups. They called them task forces, and they put eight people on each of the six I was one of the eight on the task force for the economy. There was one on healthcare, one on climate, and one on education, and so forth. So five people from the Biden team and three people from the Sanders side worked together over many months in the summer and hashed out differences and shared policy ideas and sort of helped to shape what became the platform for the administration. And in fact, the Democratic Party platform, that's where that came from.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. That's very interesting, like sort of reflecting back. So here, I think when you wrote the book, this was less of a mainstream position, but it had, in that sense, a really big impact.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, that $1.9 trillion package was really remarkable in so many ways. The chairman of the House Budget Committee was a man named John Yarmuth, a Democrat from Kentucky, who had governed his entire time in Congress as a Democrat, but saw himself very much as what he called a fiscal conservative or a deficit hawk. And, you know, he read my book, he started thinking differently, and after they moved this piece of legislation, I got a text message from him. And he's talked about this publicly, or I wouldn't be sharing the story, but he said, you know, in this message, we just passed almost a $2 trillion fiscal package, and I don't know if I would have had the courage to shepherd that bill through the House. And he's budget committee chair, so he really did shepherd the bill through. He said, I don't know if I would have had the courage to do that if it hadn't been for the confidence I gained in reading the book and changing the way I think about things. So, yeah, I think it had an impact.
Yeah, okay, interesting. And so for me, so when I was reading the book, I got the impression, or at least, like, let's say, for me, one of the main takeaways was, okay, we shouldn't worry about the fiscal deficit, that's the deficit myth, but we should worry about real deficits, that is, real problems in our economy, like, for example, healthcare not being, you know, sufficient to actually keep workers healthy, or if I want to talk about it like an economist and otherwise, about people healthy, right? And so here you could say that they stopped worrying about the monetary deficit because they were so concerned with the real deficits that COVID inflicted upon the economy. And then the final takeaway for me, at least from your book, was, hey, but, because people often say the opposite, you cannot spend indefinitely. There is a limit, and that limit is inflation. That's one of the key points of the book, right? Now, inflation happened. So how do you view that? So especially now in the light that you were helping with this spending package, you know, as a skeptic, I could maybe say, okay, it was too big because then we got this massive inflation.
Well, okay, lots to unpack there.
Yeah.
All right. We got massive inflation. Well, we had inflation, depending on which measure we're looking at. Let's take the most extreme, which was the headline CPI. So we hit 9.1% on headline CPI in June of 2022. But inflation was a global phenomenon. Countries that did much less fiscal got higher inflation than we experienced in the U.S. So, you know, getting to the source of the inflation, like where did it come from? Some people pointed to that $1.9 trillion package and said, that's where it came from. That's where all of it came from. It was the fact that Biden came in and sent that third round of stimulus checks and an expanded child tax credit that sent people more money. And it was just the sort of Milton Friedman, too much money chasing too few goods, and everybody focused on the too much money part. It was just too much money, too much stimulus. But really, it's the other part. It's the too few goods part. And you have to go all the way back to what initially set off the inflation. When it really first started to materialize, you know, it was about a month after the package passed. That stimulus package didn't send inflation to 4% in April of 2021. It couldn't have. So inflation was already picking up. It was already picking up in the early phases because, you know, the pandemic hit, we told everybody, virtually everybody, don't go to work, stay home. We didn't have vaccines, stay home, help flatten the curve. We all remember that, right? And you couldn't go to bars and restaurants and theaters and shopping malls and all the rest of it. what you could do was stay home and shop on the internet and buy goods. You could turn your spare bedroom into your home office because that's where you're going to be, you know, spending most of your time. You could remodel. You could buy kids their laptops and tablets because they were going to school remotely and that sort of thing. So we all tried to plow the money that we had into that narrow channel through the goods pipeline. And goods have to be manufactured somewhere. They have to be produced and shipped. We have global supply chains. We all know, you know, the stories of what happened in the early phase. So it's the shift in demand away from services to consumption, and then the brittle supply chains as we tried to spend, and backlogs at the ports and shipping costs, and all of that gave that initial impetus to inflationary pressures. And then a second wave of COVID and a third wave of COVID and war in Ukraine and food and energy. So what I saw was just a series of waves of supply shocks that came one after another. Now, I don't want to totally discount the role that, you know, fiscal support plays in this. It is true that people had more money to spend. And the fact that they had more money to spend did allow them to put some extra strain on the productive capacity and create some, you know, bottleneck pressures and that sort of thing. But when people look back on this, whether it's the San Francisco Federal Reserve or Moody's Analytics or, you know, any number of other Goldman, people try to kind of do the autopsy of inflation.
Yeah.
Looking back, you know, with a benefit of hindsight, where did it really come from? And, you know, I don't think I've seen any study, anything that says this is all due to, you know, fiscal stimulus, too much spending. It was the supply side stuff, which is why it's largely gone today. So the supply side is healed.
Yeah, although you could say that the demand side also, you know, is largely gone today, right? With the stimulus sort of tapering off.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You know, people seemed people would talk as if when you send someone a stimulus check, they have it and they can only spend it once and then the stimulus is done. And they sort of forget the lesson of, well, one person's spending is another person's income. So it doesn't just evaporate out of the system. Now the deposit sits somewhere else. Somebody else has it. They can turn around and spend from that. And you're whittling away at it over time as mm-hmm. taxes remove a portion of it. But there is a multiplier effect, and that spending does continue. And, you know, look at the American consumer today. Consumer spending is really resilient. We're getting real GDP growth numbers that are coming and they're just eye-popping even today. So we just have a very strong labor market. All of that has produced the sort of, you know, growth environment in which people have cushions, they're spending, and the economy is really strong.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned the studies and, you know, I think we don't know exactly what caused inflation, but I think most economists would agree that demand and supply play a role. You also have these studies that say we try to distinguish between supply and demand by looking at, hey, is more being sold than demand plays a role, or is less being sold and the price is still going up, then it's purely a supply issue. But I mean, these studies are also imperfect,
yeah.
But I do see also indeed, yeah, like energy is typically playing a big role. Food is playing a big role. It makes no sense if it was only demand. Like, why would they spend it only on energy and food, for example,
yeah.
Right?
No, of course not. That's it. And, you know, I think the ECB has done a lot of work trying to really disaggregate and say how much of the lingering inflationary pressures can be traced to this source or that source. And the one we haven't talked about, of course, is the role of corporations taking advantage during phases of the pandemic where they said, look, the consumer walks into the store expecting to pay higher prices. There is a mindset in place where people yeah. think, what is this inflation I keep hearing about? I know I'm going to have to pay more for that 12-pack of soda or that carton of eggs or whatever. And companies took advantage of that and used the opportunity to raise prices in excess of the rising prices that they were facing. Sure, wages are up. Sure, some of their raw material costs and other inputs prices are rising. They could raise prices to cover that and just protect margins, but they went beyond that in many cases. And so part of the inflation that we didn't talk about before is just due to, you know, call it what you want, seller's inflation, Isabella Weber has called it, profiteering, price gouging, greedflation. These things have all been tossed around. But that's at least some of what went on as well. And the ECB, I think more than any other central bank, has paid kind of closer attention to that.
Yeah, they recognize it. Like, they, I got the impression they don't know, and probably nobody exactly knows, how big the role of sellers, in, I like to call it sellers inflation, was versus fiscal stimulus versus monetary stimulus versus supply chain disruptions from COVID versus supply disruptions from the Ukraine war. But would you say still that, like, I mean, I think it's interesting that you say, okay, fiscal policy definitely played a role. I think that's because, like, if you talk maybe to people who see this as a nuanced issue, maybe, you, I mean, the book is also partially, as I read it, for many people who don't see this as a nuanced issue, but as a very black and white thing, right? But if you would talk to people who see this as a nuanced issue, would you be comfortable saying, okay, well, but maybe sort of fiscal policy in the end still played a role, I don't know, like one fifth or something, like something like that? Would you be comfortable?
I mean, I have not taken the effort to try to sit down and personally, you know, go through and try to identify how much of the inflationary pressure. I trust people with large staffs. I mean, I'm one person, right? Let the Federal Reserve do it. Let Moody's Analytics do it. Let others do a good job. They've got the staff. They can work through these things. So again, I'll just come back to what everybody seems to point to. And at one point, the San Francisco Fed was saying the $1.9 trillion package probably added 0.3 percentage point to the inflation, excess inflation running above 2%, 0.3 of 1%. So if that's their assessment, I'm happy to accept that, but it's trivial.
And I think you also mentioned, which I think at least is sometimes missing from the debate, how big the COVID shock like was on the economy. Like, imagine shutting down everything, and then it's maybe inevitable that there was some negative consequence to this, because it didn't show up too much in growth after a huge dip, of course, and that then came out in inflation. Maybe it becomes a political choice, in the sense that maybe it becomes a political choice. Do we want to have a huge depression, or do we want to have a recovery but with an inflationary spike? How do you view that? Is that the way to see it?
A political choice. I mean, I would take these outcomes over the alternative any day of the week. I can't imagine. I mean, you know, 22 million people lost their jobs in the first 2 months of the pandemic in the U.S. 22 million people. About 9 million people lost their jobs in the Great Recession. So it's just, it was a catastrophic human catastrophe, what was happening. And to think that you wouldn't come in and stabilize incomes in the middle of a pandemic, that people were going to be evicted from their apartments, they weren't going to be able to buy food, the livelihoods, the businesses that were all told they can't open, they would have all gone under. I mean, all of the you know, support that was given helped hold the economy together, so that when the vaccines came and the reopening started, we had that V-shaped recovery that I don't think anybody imagined was really possible. I mean, people were talking about the Nike swoosh recovery, if we could ever get there. You know, you're hearing a K-shaped recovery. It was going to be very uneven. And we got this unbelievable shortest recession in U.S. history, officially in and out of recession within the span of 2 months. Never happened before. And then, you know, the kind of rebound, we got 22 million jobs back in 2.5 years. It took us 7 years to get the 9 million jobs back after the Great Recession. So the performance was just orders of magnitude better. You know, you compare side by side the fiscal response then compared to this time, and it almost hurts to think about how much better we could have done for people in the wake of the financial crisis, but we didn't make those political choices. And a lot of people suffered for the better part of a decade because of it.
And yet, at the moment, although it's changing a little bit, I got the feeling that Joe Biden is relatively unpopular because of the economy. How do you view that issue? I've been following the debate a little bit for a video that I'm making right now, where I've been viewing a couple of different narratives about this. Like one is, well, actually, it's because of media negativity. I think Joe Biden said something like this. But then again, there are also people who are saying, well, GDP numbers might look great, but real wages have only now recovered. And poverty is up again, and inequality is up again. So actually, people are right that the recovery is not as good as the GDP numbers say. How do you view this debate?
Everything you said is true. It has always been the case that we have, you know, two Americas, in a sense. You have a large population of people who are hurting, and you have about half of the economy that's doing okay, and a smaller slice that's doing phenomenally well. One of the things that was in the COVID package, that $1.9 trillion package, was the expanded child tax credit. That lifted about 40% of all the kids in this country, in America, out of poverty. But it lasted less than a year.
Yeah.
And when it expired, there wasn't the political will to renew it. And so a lot of kids and a lot of families fell back into poverty. It's true that real wages did not keep up in the first year or two of the pandemic, but for the last 10 months, real wages have been increasing.
Yeah.
And so that's the good news. And I think, you know, it is a problem because the Biden administration has so much good data that they can run on. But at the same time, it takes a while for people to begin to feel better after months and months of, you know, paying higher prices at the pump and in grocery stores and not having your real wages keep up. There's that lingering kind of, this was a bad era for me. This was a bad time. And I think only now you're starting to see sentiment change. If you look at the latest yeah. kind of Michigan consumer sentiment, you saw a really nice pop in those numbers. And it was like, oh, what's happening here? Are people finally starting to feel the benefits of this economy? Is it reaching them? It's not reaching everyone, and it's uneven, and it always is. But some of the investments that were made dissipated, and people probably miss that support. But overall, I think, you know, it's a really good economy in the whole, right? Yeah, there are obviously people who still need assistance, and I think the administration is hoping that a lot of the manufacturing investments in the bipartisan infrastructure bill yeah. and the climate spending, that will start seeping into communities all over the country as those projects roll out. And so we'll just have to wait and see if it's soon enough to make a difference in November.
Yeah, and maybe it's also possible to recognize that it has been a very tough time still for many people. And yet, like when you say it's a really good economy, it's maybe also relative to, for example, other places, because there are not many other places that have done better. Like I'm from Europe, and yeah. we've had more of a Nike swoosh recovery. So, yeah.
You know, it is true, though. You said the media, and I didn't really pick up on that in my response, but I think it's absolutely an important factor in the way people feel. I do. I mean, I'm pretty... I won't say media savvy because that's not what I mean. I mean, I watch a lot. I'm mm-hmm. tuned in to the political discourse, and because I comment quite a bit on television, whatever, it's helpful to know what's being said. And so I watch more TV than I probably like to admit.
Yeah.
But, you know, through the pandemic and especially when inflation took off, you could not change the channel and not find a reporter standing in front of a gas station with this big sign behind them, you know, $4.79 or $5.13 or whatever. It was, or in a grocery store, or talking to somebody coming out of a grocery store. It was, you were just confronted with inflation everywhere you went. Now, obviously, people will feel it on their own in their lives, but also to have the media presenting that as the biggest story in America, and it was for the better part of a year, maybe yeah. more, an inescapable part of the public discourse. And I think it just really helped to kind of beat people down
Yeah, okay, yeah. I sometimes wonder if inflation is sort of more hated than recessions because it hits everybody. And so as, you know, I mean the media, it makes sense that a story about that attracts more viewers because it, like, you know, if you have even a stagnating economy, maybe 3% of people cannot find a job that they otherwise could. Whereas with inflation, everybody feels it.
And people say this all the time, right? That's why it's a more salient issue, whereas unemployment only affects, you know, the person who's lost their job. It's not true, right? I mean, somebody's unemployed, their family is probably impacted. When large groups of people are unemployed, like after the financial crisis, it can devastate entire communities. Property values go down. Other people are impacted by the overall state of the economy and the level of unemployment and so forth. There's a really interesting study. I didn't know we were going to talk about this, so I don't have the names of the authors kind of right at the tip of my tongue, but I think they were all from New Zealand. Anyway, I think three of them co-authored this really interesting paper together, and they looked at sort of across countries over a long period of time. When countries experience high levels of inflation and high levels of unemployment. And they surveyed people just about their general happiness and never connected, never told the people, I'm interested because I'm doing this research on inflation and unemployment. It was just, you know, are you happy? How do you feel about the world? And saying they had a survey. And so they went back and then mapped later the responses that they got. And they paid attention to whether the economy had high levels of unemployment, high levels of inflation. And what they found was that generally, people overwhelmingly are happier when unemployment is low relative to when inflation is very low. In other words, unemployment really does matter a lot. And even though inflation impacts everyone, there's something about running an economy that has a lot of people who have, you know, jobs and high employment levels that tends to make people feel better generally about the state of the economy.
Yeah, okay, interesting. I will look that up.
I'll find it. Yeah. I'll send it to you.
No, and I can imagine that there is indeed a broader effect in the sense that even if you're working, if there's low unemployment, you know, it gives a sense of comfort to know that if you lose your job, you can easily find another one, which a lot of people now have, for example, or if you're a student. And yeah, okay, that's an interesting counter argument.
Yeah.
So, you know, circling back to the book and the myths that you talk about, because you talk about several myths, and, you know, talking about if MMT is still relevant, I think the first one, you know, still is, although I could imagine that it's less controversial now, and that is that the government should not budget like a household. That's the first myth you talk about, right? I also talk about this all the time on the channel because I think that's something most macroeconomists would agree with, I hope at least, or at least in the circles that I move around. But is that also your view? Has this sort of become less controversial? I'm not saying it's gone away.
Look, when COVID hit, I had all kinds of people. I mean, the headlines in major newspapers and articles I was seeing, we're all MMTers now. You know, people were writing to me, television broadcast, host of big shows, you won, you know, this sort of stuff, as if nobody's ever going to revert back to this way of thinking about, you know, government budgeting. But you look around and you got, you know, fiscal rules and debt breaks and balanced budget amendment still pushes. We've got fiscal commission in the U.S., this push to deal with, you know, a supposed debt crisis and to establish a commission to rein in finance. And really kind of that mentality around the budget being pushed back into something like balance, you know. So I don't think that we've broken free of that. I think we broke free in COVID because we had to, and there was no concern whatsoever about budgetary impacts of spending in COVID or whether the government needed to operate its budget in a way that was consistent with old ways of thinking about fiscal responsibility. But I think it's back.
Yeah. I can see a similar dynamic in Europe as well. So I'm Dutch. And the Northern European countries also have this very strong culture of no deficits. And I see it also on the German side, that actually during the pandemic, they, you know, had the same experience as in America, I think. They spent way more than they would, not as much as in the US, but way more. And, you know, one interesting thing I saw was that the Dutch debt to GDP actually went down in that time, which makes total sense from MMT lens, right? Or even maybe an economics lens where you say, oh, well, if debt goes up, but GDP goes up more, then, of course, you know, debt to GDP goes down.
Yeah.
And the Germans were also talking about more and more like investing. Okay, we need to do some industrial policy even maybe, which was unthinkable, yeah. I think, 10 years ago. Then again, now they have the debt brake and their economy is one of the worst performers at the moment.
Yeah.
And they cannot do a lot of the plans that they wanted to.
So we have this rhetorically, many politicians still want to present the fiscal responsibility face. You know, they want to articulate plans in ways that sound like, you know, the old way of doing things. But even in the case of Germany, right, they were looking for sort of ways to do off budget, sort of we'll stick with the black zero and we'll talk about it this way, but really we're going to find ways to spend. And I think that's what we did in the U.S. as well. I mean, we literally had a piece of legislation called the Inflation Reduction Act, right? Which is a marketing thing. It's like, this is designed to, you know, be fiscally responsible, but in a good way, in a way that says, we're going to try to prevent this spending from creating inflationary problems. So they named it the Inflation Reduction Act. I don't think we could debate the extent to which it really does a lot in the near term to deal with inflationary pressures. But the reality is that they got an awful lot of climate spending into this package, and maybe under the guise of something that they sold as fiscally responsible. But so I think there are two things going on. On the one hand, they've broken free because they are running huge deficits. The U.S. is projected to run deficits that average $2 trillion over the next 10 years. That is a huge, huge difference.
Yeah. And
reasonably comfortable with that.
Yeah. But getting to then, I don't know if it's the second or third myth, but let's say the next interesting myth, where you say, okay, the deficit is not the thing we should focus on, 3% deficit, 4%, that does is not might matter, but it's not what we should focus on. We should focus on, is it causing inflation? And then if I read that chapter of the book, well, it's definitely a pre-COVID written book. That's how it came across to me, in the sense that you very much focus on the demand side. You meant to your credit, you mentioned supply push inflation, for sure, but it's not featured that much, which to me as a reader made total sense because that wasn't an issue for a long time. But is that something that you think, you know, MMT maybe should be updated on? Like, specifically, you know, maybe, because when I read the book, I was thinking, okay, maybe we should target, have an inflation target for the government. But maybe if we have a lot of supply push inflation, that inflation target for the government doesn't work. Do you see what I'm trying to say? I do,
but it's funny because the book, the core of MMT is supply constraints. I mean, that's the core, right? Mm-hmm. It says the government doesn't budget like a household. We said in the first chapter, you can't run out of money, but you can run out of things to buy. And as soon as you say that, you're talking about the supply constraints.
Yeah.
And so it's all about, and it's not just, you know, taking the supply constraints as given and then avoiding allowing demand to place excessive strain on the supply capacity. It's about building capacity. It's about recognizing that if you want to spend more, that you've got to be able to do so in a way where the productive capacity is there to allow you to do that. So go back to the, you know, Inflation Reduction Act or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill or the CHIPS and Science Act. These are the three big pieces of legislation that Democrats have passed recently. Yeah. All of them are oriented around adding capacity to the U.S. economy so that you can safely spend more because you're spending more into an economy with growing productive capacity. And, you know, Janet Yellen has described it as, she came out and she said, the White House and the Biden administration has a new philosophy for economics, and we call it modern supply-side economics. And as soon as she said it, someone from the Trump administration, I think it was Kevin Hassett, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal or someplace, and he said, Janet Yellen is an MMT-er because So see, he picked up right away on the parallel there, which is paying attention to capacity constraints. That's the core of message of the book, is that...
Fair enough, yeah. Maybe I was referring more to, so because I think what we saw was a massive supply shock, in the sense that it's a shock, like a one-time thing. And, you know, that was not discussed so much in that chapter, which again, I think makes sense because it hadn't happened that for a long time.
Well, that was the thing. And I said in that chapter, you know, no one knows when or if inflation will ever present a problem again. I mean, we've gone 30 years or more with, you know, very, very modest inflation globally, right? Mm-hmm. Central banks trying desperately to push inflation up to 2%. And struggling to do so. And so I said, who knows when and whether it will reemerge. Anything can happen. And I said, you know, wars, I didn't use the word pandemic in that piece, but I said supply chains, I said oil shocks, I said, you know, climate and food, you know, crop failures and all those sorts of things. So preparedness is a big thing. I had an op-ed that I wrote in 2017, when Donald Trump was president, and I called it how to spend trillions on infrastructure. And that piece did talk about pandemic preparedness and what you need to do to build capacity through infrastructure and other kinds of investments. So I've written about it, but you're right. In the first book, there wasn't a sort of blueprint for how to respond in real time to a pandemic or a breakdown of global supply chains.
Which, you know, nobody can fault you for, because you cannot know everything in advance, of course. But, you know, in that light, would an inflation targeting government, you know, using the lens of MMT, be looking at sort of long-term inflation, like, for example, and then plan supply in the long term ahead for that? Like, for example, now, like, let's say I'm an inflation targeting government, would I be thinking, okay, geopolitics is becoming more of a thing right now, so I want to do a little bit of reshoring, which is basically also part of the Inflation Reduction Act and CHIPS Act, I think, right?
Yeah.
Like, because that builds sort of real resilience, I guess, which then translates in resilience to inflation. And similarly, I know that, for example, China has this pork reserve, right? And I think they also have a grain reserve and an oil reserve. Yeah. Is that an MMT way, or is it at least compatible with the MMT way of looking at inflation?
Yes. I mean, MMT, you know, MMT has a buffer stock scheme as a proposal for a price anchor, and that's part of the inflation fighting sort of toolkit in MMT. But historically, we drew that from historical examples where buffer stocks were used for all sorts of things in agricultural and cotton and, you know, farming and those sorts of things. You mentioned China. So absolutely consistent, yes, thinking about the extent to which, with long-term planning in mind, you want to build an economy that's more resilient to these sort of geopolitical and other kinds of threats. Yeah, it makes sense to think about that. I guess the question is, you know, you're hearing people talk about reshoring, and we're doing some of that. You hear people talk about friendshoring. I don't exactly know, sometimes in a world like the one we have today, who's your friend today, who's your friend tomorrow? I mean, I won't name names, but we can all think of countries where the leadership has changed, has swung, you know, in the recent elections, from somebody who would have been a friend you might have negotiated a trade deal with and said, we're friendshoring, so let's start establishing relationship. One election later, you're dealing with a very different person and maybe not a partner. So there are all kinds of risks, and none of them you can totally insulate yourself from. But for sure, when you're thinking about the production channels and inflationary pressures and risks associated with resourcing critical needs, national security, baby formula, food, grains, you know, all of those things, energy,
And so one of the main points I think you also discuss in the book is that We at the moment, practically and also in the economics profession, mainly view the central bank as the fighter of inflation. I think we already talked about this a little bit, of course, but you focus way more on the government as the fighter of inflation in the sense that, and also the main cause of inflation, is how I read it. At least, that's maybe a bit too
strongly. Yeah, I wouldn't say that.
That's put too strongly since we discussed supply, so... But at least that the responsibility, how I read it, the main responsibility of the government is fighting inflation. It's not the main responsibility of the central bank. Did I read that correctly?
Well, if what you're saying is that I'm making the argument that it's a mistake to rely on central banks deal with inflation, especially to rely on central banks exclusively to deal with inflation using the existing toolkit, that I think is demonstrably problematic. I mean, I mentioned a few moments ago that we watched central banks try to hit a 2% inflation target for the better part of a decade, and in Japan for the better part of three decades. Bernanke and Janet Yellen tried for 10 years to move inflation up to 2%. They couldn't do it. The ECB struggled to push inflation to 2%. They couldn't do it. I can go on down the list, right? So there's a problem with the idea that central banks have a very powerful tool at their disposal, which is a single price in the entire economy, right? Mm-hmm. The overnight interest rate. And they can just sort of dial it down and dial inflation up, or dial the interest rate up and dial inflation down. And we're just supposed to rely exclusively on this tool to deal with any and all potential inflation. I think that's a huge problem. And when the inflation first broke out, Jerome Powell would come to the podium and inflation was picking up and there was a lot of pressure and people were saying, what is the Federal Reserve doing? They're falling behind the curve. Why isn't Powell raising rates? And he would come out and very, calmly explain, the Federal Open Market Committee has met and decided today to hold interest rates at the current level, which was essentially zero. We're not responding to this pickup in inflation because we don't believe that our tools will be effective at bringing this inflation down. And he would just go through it and he would say, we're seeing it in used car prices for these reasons related to semiconductors, and I can't make semiconductors with my interest rate tools, so we're not responding. And then later it was another driver and he said, it's energy, I can't deal with that. And so for many months, he said, our tools are designed to work on the demand side. This pressure is coming from the supply side, therefore the Fed is not moving. And then at some point, the Fed obviously began to move. And other central banks, not the Bank of Japan, but most other central banks started to move. Now we have this debate, I think, about whether how much the increase in interest rates has actually played a role in bringing inflation down.
What do you think? Did it play a big role?
No.
Okay.
Because I think inflation has come down largely for the same reasons that it went up, mm-hmm. which is supply shocks drove it up, and the abatement of those shocks has led naturally to the disinflation that we have experienced over time. I mentioned earlier inflation peaked in June of 2022. The Fed started raising rates in March of 2022. There is no way that inflation started coming down because the Fed raised interest rates 25 basis points two times. And that's why peak inflation happened. Alan Blinder, the former vice chair of the Federal Reserve, wrote about this. And he said, look, by the second half of 2022, inflation was running about 2%. And he said, this has nothing to do with, this was a 6-month annualized second half of 22. He said the Fed has barely moved interest rates and inflation has come crashing down and it doesn't have anything to do with the hiking of interest rates. Look at Japan, which didn't hike at all.
Yeah, and it also
and inflation
it goes against,
crashed down.
It goes against, I think, mainstream empirical research as well, which says interest rates take approximately, I don't know the exact number, but a year or two or whatever to take an effect.
See, this is the other thing. I think people are just reverse engineering their narratives to fit whatever story they're trying to tell. If you want to make the argument that the central banks have, done the heavy lifting and that the rate hikes really did work, you engineer your story to get you there. But before we were hearing people say the lags have actually gotten shorter. We used to say long and variable lags. Maybe it's 18 months, maybe it's 24 months. And then all of these people came out of the woodwork early on as inflation started to come down in June after it peaked. And they said, I think the lags are actually very short now. I think, you know, the transmission mechanism is just much cleaner and maybe central bank shaping of expectations works faster, whatever. I mean, people just said all kinds of things. I think the most straightforward story is probably the right one, which is that the supply chains healed, things normalized, and inflation came back down.
Yeah, and I would also argue that fiscal stimulus stopped as well.
Well, all evidence to the contrary.
No, I mean, like the stimulus checks, for example, right? The tax credit that you mentioned.
That stopped, but the deficit collapsed in 2022. It collapsed. Yeah. I mean, that's when I got worried. That's when my recession sort of, radar started to get triggered. Yeah. Because I saw this huge collapse in the deficit in 2022, and I thought, oh, dear. And growth slowed, and we had the two consecutive quarters of declining real GDP, and it looked like here we are. And then we got the bipartisan infrastructure, the CHIPS, the Inflation Reduction Act, and I will add the rate hikes. The rate hikes took us from 0 to 5.25, and today as we sit here, the Congressional Budget Office in their latest budget outlook report says the single biggest contributor to the deficit today are the rate hikes. The interest rate increases by the Fed are forcing Treasury to pay out hundreds of billions of dollars additional in interest income to bondholders. And so you add $350 billion more in interest income to the Inflation Reduction Act, the climate spending, and the infrastructure, and the CHIPS, and you have fiscal policy that is it was like 7% of GDP. Deficit is about 7% of GDP right now.
So I'm glad you bring this up because this is, I think, one of the more controversial points of MMT, at least in the economics profession. And that is that if you raise interest rates as a currency issuing government, then you're effectively paying out a sort of subsidy or to the holders of your bonds, which are typically people who are wealthier. But I also sometimes, I think that's not particularly controversial, but what I do think is more controversial is that I sometimes at least get the feeling from MMT proponents, and I think you've been quoted, or I've seen a quote of you on Twitter as well, that this might even be inflationary. So hiking interest rates is inflationary because as a government you spend more. But there I wonder if that effect is not really small because you're spend that goes to people who already have a lot of wealth that do not spend it. And then, of course, on the other side, you have the lending channel, right? Which is that, okay, people borrow less because interest rates are. So, you know, I've come across that argument and I thought, I think it's really valid that you talk about it because it is a channel. As economists, we often like to talk about channels. And then I think the discussion becomes, which channel is the most important? But could it be that, would you argue that that channel is so big or so important for inflation, so interest income coming to more people, creating inflation, that is so big that it offsets the less borrowing that higher interest rates have as a consequence?
All right, so lots there. First of all, there is not a whole lot of evidence, and we don't see it in the data, that spending by the private sector is highly sensitive to interest rates. It's just not there. I mean, we're not seeing it. There are sectors of the economy that are supposed to be more interest sensitive than others, durable goods, especially automobiles, and housing. We know that, right? So you look at what's happened since the Fed embarked on this, you know, most aggressive tightening cycle in 40 years. Yeah, there was a housing slowdown, but we seem to have stabilized, and now home builders are building homes again, and people are taking out loans and trying to buy homes. We have a massive shortage. We are short, depending on the estimate, somewhere between 2 and 6 million homes in the US, and people will start building and people will buy homes as long as the interest rates just stabilize. People just need to have a sense that they're not gonna continue you know, going up or something along those lines. So there are two channels. You just laid them out. One, the central bank hikes interest rates and credit gets more expensive. Firms might not borrow to do projects that penciled out at lower interest rates, and maybe they cancel them at higher rates. Some households won't borrow for that house or that car because it's just gotten a little too expensive, the credit card payments and so forth. On the other hand, as you said, raising interest rates puts a lot of additional income into people's hands. And it's not just through the government. We've got $6 trillion or $7 trillion in money market accounts right now. Those are paying out. People are getting interest income, right, from not just the government, but other sources as well. So government is a net payer of interest. You got about $1 trillion being paid out in interest income. And you say, well, what's the which of those forces is winning? Are the rate hikes creating enough unwillingness to borrow and spend that it's producing a drag? Or are the headwinds not as strong and the tailwinds are dominating? And so I just look at the data and I say, since the Fed started raising interest rates, what has happened? Has spending accelerated or decelerated? Is the economy growing faster or more slowly? And the answer is we're growing much more robustly with the rate hikes in place. If the rate hikes worked, growth should have decelerated.
But although that could have been offset by more government spending from the CHIPS Act, Inflation Reduction Act, all of that, right?
Well, that's also fiscal expansion, so yes.
So that could have offset, maybe the central bank was decreasing spending, but the government increased it more.
Well, part of the reason the government is increasing more and the fastest growing component is the interest expenditure. I don't disagree with you that the propensity to spend out of interest income is probably relatively low. No one ever bothers to try to find out what it is. I've never seen those studies. It would be helpful to know what they are. But let me just say this. The other thing is, this is not an MMT point. This is mainstream macroeconomic fiscal sustainability literature. The models themselves say that beyond some point, if the debt ratio, if there's enough public debt out there, right, if the debt is large enough and interest rates are increasing, that you can get into a situation where the interest increases in interest create the inflation. And that's what they worry about. That's when they start talking about fiscal dominance. And they say at that point, the central bank isn't free to run monetary policy independent of what's happening on the fiscal side because the rate hikes are producing inflation. And inflation fighting central bank is now caught in a trap.
Okay, interesting.
So that's their model. That's not even MMT. We're just pointing out that, you know, there is a risk that beyond some point, the debt is large enough, and in an environment where the central bank is raising interest rates, those interest rate increases lead to increased payments to people, and that income is available to be spent just like any other source of income. And if people turn around and spend enough of that, you can create a situation where the rate hikes produce inflation. That's not the only inflation channel, just to be clear, right?
Okay. I mean, the rate. It's a possibility, but then, I guess we get back to how I said that economists like to talk about transmission channels, and then the debate becomes which one is the most important. And then, but that now I sense sort of a very nuanced, like what you're saying is, okay, this is a channel. And I think most people would agree, like, okay, that's possible, but I think the majority position at the moment would be, but that's an edge case that doesn't happen so much. And I'm not entirely sure if you're saying, no, actually that happens more than you think, you don't know, maybe that could also be possible.
I think that, look, if we push, all we have to do is keep raising interest rates. And I think we can resolve the question probably just by looking at the impact and what actually happens. If we go from 5 to 10 to 15 to 20% interest to 30% interest, very quickly, I imagine, there's going to be enough interest income that we're going to be able to see, you know, the situation. What are people doing with all of this income? Either they're going to turn around and spend it, and you're going to create inflationary problems, or you're absolutely going to crush the economy, and you're going to have a deep recession. One of those two things is going to happen. And no, I'm not saying, and I don't think anybody in MMT is saying, that it will always only generate one outcome. which is the higher inflation. Yeah. But that's just the mainstream model. And we're just sort of reminding them that, hey, you know, there is a channel here that you guys are overlooking. Because they tend to think of the interest rate hikes as only the brake pedal in the car. You raise interest rates, that slows everything down. And we're saying, no, there's a channel through which you can actually accelerate. It actually works like the gas pedal, and you're forgetting that. And also, you know, raising interest rates to the extent that you do discourage people from building homes, from businesses, from investing in new capital and building out capacity and so forth. That's just hampering your productive capacity. That's reducing supply. And so you look at housing, and I, you know, had this conversation with some mainstream economists and said, you think the Fed rate hikes are, you know, only going to work to bring down inflation, but what about the possibility that they produce stickier inflation or even cause inflation to go up? Because now you have less supply, less capacity, and so you can have, you know, home prices increasing because shortages of supply.
Firms
raising prices to cover costs. If interest is a cost to businesses that borrow to finance working capital and interest rates are increasing, that's an increasing cost just like any other cost for a business. So if businesses are relying on short-term debt and they're rolling it over and they have to pay higher rates, why wouldn't they increase prices to try to protect margins? And so there's another channel through which you can get rising rates to rising prices.
That's tricky. I think this is something I've, when I try to cover inflation on the channel, I've come across, like on the YouTube channel, I have to say, not the economics transmission channel, but that there are just so many channels, and it's not that simple.
Yep.
And actually, I think a lot of central bankers also say this, if you read between the lines a little bit, like, of course, they have their simple models that are still somewhat important and still maybe sort of guide a lot of the thinking, but especially the people who do the sort of the more empirical research or who are doing the practical work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you come across this very often because precisely what you said, I follow ECB research on inflation quite closely, and they definitely mentioned, like, they did also mention, like, okay, we see spending slowing down in housing, we see spending slowing down in a lot of investment from companies and car loans, for example, as we raised interest rates. But they also say, we're kind of worried if we're slowing down company investment, will we get more inflation in the future?
Yeah.
And they also say, but there are still some mysteries sometimes, like the US housing market, for example, or like even in Europe, housing prices didn't drop as quickly as they expected. Yeah.
I know so, Jerome Powell, in his remarks just a day or two ago, made the comment that, you know, somebody asked him, the press, are the rate hikes working? How do you see them working? Because it seems like the economy is growing faster now than it was before you started raising interest rates. Here we are 525 basis points later. How are the interest rate increases working? And he said, well, they're working in the interest sensitive parts of the economy. He mentioned housing. He said, we've seen a slowdown there. And then he immediately said, but we have shortages. I mean, we don't have enough homes. And then he said, but there's nothing the Fed can do about that. I thought, well, if the rate hikes have slowed the housing, production, it seems to me maybe there is something you can do about that. You know, it was a sort of strange thing to think. We've raised interest rates. It slowed the housing production of homes and home buying. We have a shortage. There's nothing we can do about that.
So in an ideal world, let's say in the MMT world, sticking with the MMT theme, would the central bank and the government work together to, in synchronization, fight inflation, and then the central bank focuses on the parts that they can control and the government focuses on the parts that they can control?
I guess it depends who you ask. I mean, I know you had a conversation with Warren Mosler, and Warren likes the idea of a zero interest rate, permanent zero interest rate policy.
Yeah.
I had a recent piece in the FT. I leaned into that as well. I don't think that it has served us well over the broad span of the last 40 years, 50 years, relying on central banks to monkey around with the interest rate to try to fine-tune the economy. I think it would be better to anchor it and leave it be, and then focus on macroprudential regulation. There are other things the central bank can do to build out a more sophisticated toolkit to deal with credit markets and credit creation and potentially inflationary pressures there. But yeah, I think we need a much more sophisticated, fine-tuned, all hands on deck approach to inflation.
Yeah.
That brings in different agencies. I've talked in my book about the Congressional Budget Office. I mean, that could be a very important player in this, where if governments are thinking about committing, you know, resources and saying we want to spend hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars doing this and that and the other, and you send the legislation over to your budget scorekeeper and you say, tell me if I've written a good bill, and all they care about is whether you kept it deficit neutral, that's not very useful. But if you can get agencies to give you impact input to say, look, if you move forward with this, we've assessed the productive capacity. We are looking, and we think you're going to create bottlenecks and inflationary pressures of this kind. You need to mitigate those things before you move forward. Maybe you might have to turn a 3-year spending plan into a 5 or 7 year plan or something like that. So you need a lot more input-output modeling, more sophisticated methodology to help, I think, guide lawmakers so that they can make, you know, responsible decisions when they're thinking about large-scale spending programs.
Yeah. So the final thing I wanted to talk to you about is you often talk about the United States. It makes total sense because you're from the United States. But you mentioned in the book, like, modern monetary theory is, and you contrast it with gold standard thinking. And you say, okay, this MMT is extremely relevant for the United States today because it's in a unique fiat position where there's no sort of money higher than the US dollar, if we think about it as a sort of hierarchy.
But I don't say that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think in the book that I say that the US is unique because it's the global. In fact, I try to rebut that. It's because it's a common argument that,
MMT
is sort of U.S.-centric and it relies on the status of the dollar at the center of the global financial, but it doesn't at all.
But you mention it in relation to other, like, other monetary independent countries,
yeah.
Right? That's fair,
yeah.
I think, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, I wanted
okay,
to get
sure.
to that. Because you do go into the unique role of the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
But indeed, you say then, right after that, basically, but there are many countries like the United Kingdom, like Canada, like Australia, with floating exchange rates that also have monetary independence, right? So I'm, since we're in the UK right now at the, at the Warwick's Economic Summit, I wanted to ask you, using this framework, how did you see the gilt crisis that we've seen in the UK here quite recently, where they, at least the dominant narrative was, Liz Truss wanted to spend too much in form of a tax break, and then international investors did actually lose confidence in the pound, and the pound crashed. So maybe the UK is not fully monetary independent? Is that a correct way of saying it, or not?
No. No, Liz Truss, what she lost was her resolve. That's what she lost. So financial markets will test you, and they do that all the time. They've tried to test the Japanese government many times. There's a name for it, the trade, right? The widowmaker. Those financial players who think that they're going to bully a government, they're going to come in and they're going to flex their muscle and they're going to demand higher yields or punish a government for what is perceived as, you know, something they don't like, irresponsible, whatnot. The Japanese government has absolutely demonstrated that when the resolve is there, mm-hmm. that they cannot get away with that. In the case of Liz Truss and the debacle here, I would just say that what I saw was financial markets testing the resolve of the government, clearly reading correctly that the Tories were in something like disarray. They were not all on the same page with respect to this program. And the Bank of England did not do what the Bank of Japan does, which is to step in and show them who's boss.
Yeah.
And so she walked away. I mean, that's just what happened. You
right.
know, there's an economist in the U.S., his name is Narana Kochalakota. He was the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank. And after you know, this started happening in the UK, he wrote, now remember he was at the Fed, he was president of the Minneapolis Fed, he said, this is the Bank of England. This isn't financial markets. He was taking the narrative that everybody was saying and saying, oh, this is what happens when markets don't think that you're credible. They mm-hmm. will punish you, and there's nothing you can do about it, and that's why you must always put forward a fully costed, credible plan. And he said, no, not at all. That's not what happened. This is just that the government, Bank of England, didn't do what the Bank of Japan does, and that's the result.
Right, okay. Yeah. So when I was reading this part, and then this is really where we have to wrap up, I think, but when I was reading this part, it actually reminded me about the impossible trinity. That's a popular concept in international economics, where you have to balance monetary policy independence, a fixed exchange rate, and capital controls. And it really, I was thinking, can you maybe say, like, you have the MMT impossible trinity, where you have to balance fiscal freedom, a fixed exchange rate, and capital controls. Is it
fixed exchange rates?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Because you say, is that right? Yeah.
Capital controls?
Yeah. So the free capital. So the monetary the impossible trinity is like you can only have two things. Right, you can only have.
I'm familiar with the conventional one, no. But I'm trying to keep up with your because you're saying you have to pick MMT fixed exchange rates or.
No, not MMT. You have to pick free capital. That's the same as in the impossible trinity normally. Fixed exchange rates or fiscal policy freedom. So, because you focus more on fiscal policy than on monetary policy, right? So I just replace monetary policy with fiscal policy. So, you know, you talk about the Eurozone, for example, where you say, well, they don't have this fiscal policy freedom because they have free capital, and they have a fixed exchange rate with, you know, each other, right?
Well, they have a central bank. I mean, this is the thing, right? They can have their, in a sense, fiscal space restored if they have the backing of the ECB, which is what happened when the pandemic started. And that was what, I think that's such an important lesson, because when the financial crisis happened after 2008, and you had Draghi in there, and you didn't get that immediate sort of backing and backstopping, full backstopping of the ECB, and we let the wheels come off. They let the wheels come off, right? And a full-blown debt crisis and yields blowing out and all that sort of stuff. When the pandemic started, you may remember Christine Lagarde saying, as yields started, spread started to widen, and she said, it's not the job of the ECB to manage spreads. And I thought, oh my God, are you kidding? We're not going to do this again, are we? And I had that moment of panic. And then within, I think, a day or so, that was all walked back. And the ECB was doing exactly what it needed to do, which was to tell governments, the Italian government and everybody else, you spend what you need to spend, and we have your back. So it's a political choice. It's not this holy trinity that, you know, there's no way you must choose. It's a political choice.
Yeah,
you can have
your
sovereignty restored.
All right. Thank you so much. I think we touched upon, well, at least for me, the standouts of the book. We have not touched upon everything in the book, obviously.
No, so thank you. That was great.
Definitely read it. And I think they'll find that it's way more nuanced than, I guess, what the popular idea of MMT is. And thank you for coming on to, you know, clarify even more so many of the current issues that we're facing today through the MMT lens.
Great.
Thank you.